Okay, so welcome to Drinks with Shrinks. Jessica and Peter, we're here. I figured we don't have to introduce ourselves every single time. Yeah,
you guys know who we are.
No, we all know who you are. If you're already listening, and if this is your third time, then you know us very, very well. So we always like to ask, what are you drinking? What are you drinking, Jessica?
I actually finished it because I have a little bit of a cough thing going on, but I have a nice Earl Grey classic, but. Yeah, it hits nice. A spot, you know. Sometimes you just need tea.
Have you ever had what is it? A hot toddy? It's a southern.
No, drink. What is that?
Oh my gosh, the hot toddy is. Yeah, so a hot toddy is a southern drink, it's so good. It's it can be used with bourbon, but typically it's really really good for colds, and it's about 3/4 cup of black tea. So you get a little tea. Earl Grey is really good. A shot of whiskey or bourbon is really good. Get a little lemon in there. It's really good that you get a teaspoon of honey and put a little cinnamon stick in there. Make your cough go away immediately. So yeah, it's an old school recipe. Yeah. I could send that to you. So just make sure you put that shot of whiskey, and that really nice lemon and honey and cinnamon all will clear you up right away. So it's a.
I wish I knew that back in the day.
I know. It's very good.
It's a good thing. We all need just a little bit of whiskey.
I know. It's so much better than like cough medicine, that nasty cough medicine. But actually, it's funny. I had a pretty bad head cold about 2 months ago, and I went to Gulu Gulu Cafe, which is a really great little place, and they made me a little hot toddy. They knew exactly what it was, and it just like made it go. So anyway, well, thanks everyone for listening. We're going to be talking today about when parents disagree. But Jessica and I are both marriage and family therapists, so we see this a lot. So I would love to hear what are some of the common things that you see, and let's dive right in, because we see this almost all the time. Two parents, whether it's straight households or gay and lesbian households, whatever it is, we see this quite a bit. And it's often very, very difficult because both of them feel like they're doing the right thing. So what are some common occurrences that you can think of and some things that you often see? And I'll share with that as well.
I think this is a big one that comes up so much with people. Because again, you have two very different, you're in a relationship, but you're two different people with two different upbringings. And so I see it a lot around discipline with kids, you know, expectations of kids too. And even as something as, you know, a routine at bed, what time they should be going to bed, or, you know, who does what, or do we give rewards? Do we take things away? I think these all come up and they create tension, because then people feel like we're not on the same team. You're going against me, and that doesn't.
Right. Matter. Yeah.
Where do you see it, Peter, a lot with your couples or with people you work with?
Yeah. Same thing. Like mainly with parenting, discipline. I mean, I'm trying to think, like probably co-sleeping. I saw that a lot when I was first starting. I never really had an opinion about it. My opinions have varied all throughout the past few years, especially teaching psych at Endicott. At first I was like, I didn't really care. And then I would have a lot of patients or people where, they would allow their child to sleep with them all the way up to like, I've even seen like up to 14. And one of the things that I would often see when I would meet with a parent, that you get a radically different story from them than you would from the child. And so whenever I would meet with the child, they were often like, I would ask them about like sleeping with their parents. These are kids like after the age of 8, and almost all of them would say, I just don't really want to sleep with mom anymore, but I really worry about her. So that's really where they're coming from. But they were overly worried about mom. But when you listen to mom, she was like, I just really wish Johnny would leave the bedroom. But she wasn't necessarily being firm in her boundaries with it. And dad would often be sleeping in like the living room or a different, totally different room. And there would be a whole lot of tension. Whenever you bring it up, it would be pretty, pretty heated arguments, because everyone had different opinions. And so as a family therapist, I felt like the best thing to do is to talk to all of them individually and get their own voices, and then come together and say, actually, little Johnny worries about you. And when mom would hear something about that, she would be often horrified. She was like, oh my gosh, I don't want him to worry about me. But then her boundaries would be really vague at the very end of the night. And then that's why little Johnny would be like, okay, I guess I need to go back into mom's bed because I'm a little scared that she's, you know, he wouldn't necessarily know how to communicate that. So I would say that's something that I often see. It's just a common occurrence. I'm careful with that because there are different cultures that kind of co-sleep for many years. But at the same time, you know, that could really affect your sex life. It affects, you know, independence with children, all this other stuff you can get into. I would also just say, you know, electronics is another thing that we often see. Typically, also genders, you know, so you have all the older little boys get, you know, especially they often will transition as they're transitioning into adulthood. They need more male influence in their lives. And so I often... And vice versa with girls, they often will need more of the influence from mom right around the teenagers. I do think that there's a few years where they're often longing for that and helping each parent kind of back off a little bit if they're willing to kind of help, you know, maybe the, especially the father to like influence his son a lot more during that time. So there's just, of course, like with divorce homes, you get a lot of, all these different range of opinions as well. But I would just say, you know, I think just the amount of input that each parent can actually have on their child and without the other one feeling like they have to disagree in front of the child. So those are just some random things that I could think of. I'm sure as the more we talk, other things will often come up as well.
Yeah, but those are big ones. And especially the electronic one, I feel, as we are more and more in that tech world now, I feel like technology is right at your fingertips, you know, and it's much, I know kids will say, you know, I want the phone, I want the tablet. And it's something where, right. You know, parents are tired and sometimes they need a break. And what's the line between that break and just needing a moment to pause for your own self-care and then also that screen time? It's
a tricky thing. Yeah.
Very true.
Right. Well, we often too, I mean, you know, so, I mean, what's your recommendations on that? I mean, is it because mom and dad are not necessarily getting along, or are there other things that you're often noticing? I mean, how would you counsel, like say, for example, where mom and dad are disagreeing on discipline? You know, what's your general advice on that, or what's your take on that?
Yeah, when they disagree on discipline, how to approach that?
Yeah.
So one, I mean, I'm not saying it has to be always a huge, deep conversation, but I do think there's value in understanding each other's positions a little bit more because I think it helps to build a little bit more compassion for the other person, because instead of just seeing it as, you know, you're being too strict, you have a little bit more understanding of the value behind that person's approach or your partner's approach, because maybe in their family growing up, this is the impact it had, and they're trying to create that strength or skill set in their children now, right? Because it worked for them. And so it's not something meant to be more punitive, but it, in their eyes, they view it as a service they're giving to their child, right? In that approach. And so I think if one, you can have a conversation about just like, can you help me understand what your goal is? Can you help me understand, you know, the value you see in this approach? It starts a dialogue. And I think it also, again, just builds that compassion and understanding. And then from there, things get a little bit more malleable. And the other thing I do actually, and I don't know if this fits or answers a specific question, but you said earlier about having everyone having a voice. Mm. And one of the things that I actually started doing way back in the day, I learned it over in my training program, was a family mission statement. So it's trickier to do with kids that are very little, but what you do is you come together as a family and you talk about on a poster board, on a piece of paper, whatever you have. And you just talk about, you know, as a family, how do we want to feel? You know, just name as many feelings as you want. And then you say, you know, well, what are some of the things that get in the way of feeling that way? And and when that happens, how do we, what do we want to do when those things come up? So as a family, everyone's putting in their input. It's kind of creating a rubric for, it's not just one person's way and we're neglecting the other person's way. We're all working together. And I think it can be very insightful too, to learn from the kids what they respond to, and things that they're looking for.
Right.
And so that's one approach, that I use sometimes as well. But with discipline, I would say understanding where each other's coming from, and then also just trying to find that middle ground with each other as much as you can. It's not easier said than done.
Sure. Yeah.
It can't just be all one way.
Right. Yeah. Well, and also I often, so, I mean, you bring up some really great points, because a mission statement would be really good. We should probably also just say that each child is, you know, if you look at Piaget sensory motor stage, you know, it's going to be radically different from, you know, the latter stages, especially when it comes to, you know, the second stage, when it comes to just like concrete operations and then all the, you know, so kids are just learning radically different. Sometimes you have to kind of help the parent even understand basic child development. So when you're, what I often see with parents is that they have a tendency to with really young kids up until about the age of seven, even, they'll bring on very complex emotions and they'll project them on their children as if they're going through those same emotions. And I'm amazed at the lack of child development, that often is integrated in our culture, because it was only about 100 years ago that we saw like children like mini adults, basically. And
right my mind. That's what
I mean, 100%. At the same time, we also probably we're in this weird phase where we also look at children as if they don't have any type of resilience either. We almost see them as just like pure blank slates that, are going to be overly influenced by their natural environment. And we don't bring in like the genetic dispositions of that, you know? So we have a lot of parents, I think today, that have so much parental guilt. I think parents today probably face more guilt than they ever have in any probably recorded history. The kind of responsibilities I think a lot of parents put on themselves that at the end of the day probably don't matter. Like I see a lot of parents, oh my gosh, I didn't play with my child for an hour today. I'm like, well, okay. My parents didn't play with me either, but I'm pretty sure that their parents didn't. I was like, you know, I mean, I guess like, yeah, I'm not saying you should not play with your kid, but I mean, it's amazing how, anyway, we're in this kind of weird balance, I would say too, that we either see kids as mini adults or we see them as so fragile that we have a tendency to maybe overly hover. So child development can be really helpful, because you kind of, it allows you to maybe understand the phase or the stage where children are at. So if they say, for example, are in the sensory motor stage from one, you know, infant to two, they're all physical. So they're very reflective. So if they hit you, for example, in the face, they're not being mean. They don't even understand that. It's literally their reflexes and they're trying to manipulate their environment. That's really what it is. Now, if they're 3 to 5, and they start like telling lies and stuff like that, it's not the same as like, quote, manipulating. I will often hear parents say, my 5-year-old's manipulating the environment. No, they're not.
Master manipulator.
The problem with that is like your child who's 5 or 6 doesn't even have the ability to understand where another person's perspectives are coming from, because the ability to manipulate assumes that you know what you want and you know what the other person wants, and you have the ability to kind of maneuver that for your own advantage. That's way too technical for a 5-year-old to be able to do that, or a 7-year-old. Now, it may look like, quote, manipulation on your end, but it's not. It's totally different. It's and gosh, I just read this recently, like even teenagers, they did this study in the human brain, in the brain of teenagers. They had a control group of like over 200 teenagers, and they did MRIs and, you know, they did brain scans, and what they did is that they noticed that whenever a mom or a dad would like speak, typically the mom, like when she would like be talking to her teenager, it would go to a different side of the brain where he would just hear white noise. And that was actually, it was essential that 12 to about 15 year olds would go through that phase so that if they didn't go through that phase, their brain would end up being overly anxious for the parent. And these are what you would call parentified children, where they end up carrying more of a load for parental responsibilities throughout their lives. So it's actually essential that teenagers from about 12 to 15 kind of learn how to tune you out, because that's actually a natural part of the process. So it gives gives them the ability to take initiative and take risks. So anyway, not to get too technical here, but I often tell parents, like, read a book on child development just to understand, you know, where your brain, the brain of your child is. Daniel Siegel, for example, has a really, really great, The Whole Brain Child is fantastic. It's like 110 pages long, very short, quick read. You can read it in like just one sitting. Just a good general overview of maybe where your children are at. Because anyway, yeah, I mean, I think there's some psychoeducation that we need to kind of discuss before we could talk about parental differences, because, you know, discipline even, you know, by itself, like how do you discipline a 5-year-old versus a 12-year-old, you know, or a 15-year-old? Those are all going to be radically different. I don't know if you wanted to add to some of that too.
No, I think that's a really important point to make, because yes, I think when we talk about discipline, you need to also understand the development of your child and what they're able to, where things are coming from at their age level and what's happening in that phase of their development, so that you can understand how to also engage with that stage in a way your child's able to receive. Because I do hear often a lot, like, child's being viewed as these mini adults on the one end, and that's something where children don't have the tools to regulate in the same way. They don't have the words always to describe what they feel. And so emotions get big, and when they're big, they come out sometimes physically, they come out when a child could be sad or anxious, it can present as more irritability or angry outbursts. And I think in that way, it's important to also understand they may not be able to sit down and have a full dialogue about where that emotion is coming from. It helps the parents too to set realistic expectations for themselves. To kinder to themselves too, because I do think there's an expectation in today's world where parents need to be on all the time.
Yeah.
And that is such guilt when you're not. To your other point. And so I think in understanding the development, it allows parents also to, one, reassure themselves in what they're doing, to adjust what they're doing. It doesn't have to be this one way all the time, but to understand how to adjust how they're engaging with their child over the course of time. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. I think those are really important points.
I'm wondering if maybe it would be helpful to kind of go over some of those stages too. I mean, one of the, you bring up iPad, for example. Okay. This is just me. I'm not a fan of giving kids electronics for at least the first 2 years, maybe just like really, really, really limiting your time with that, because during the first 2 years, those are your coordination, senses, sensory curiosity about the world, cataloging, all those things are so good. Object permanence, for example, that's also where that's developed. Object permanence, what that is just explain to our listeners, like, that's where peekaboo kind of comes in. Like, you just kind of go, you know, peekaboo. Right. What's actually going on with a little kid is like, they don't understand that when I hide myself, I'm actually like behind my own hands. And that's why whenever I like surprise them, they're like, oh my gosh, that's so funny. You know, they're literally needing all of these physical things. They're very fit. We're made to physically manipulate our environment during those years. So when you're sticking in front of a screen, you prevent yourself from like developing a lot of those reflexes that are so needed. Now, again, like, I gave my kids a little iPad here and there, but you don't, My strong opinion is like, you want to make sure that your kids around that phase know what to do with crayons and know what to, like, they don't understand boredom yet. That's the other thing. So a lot of parents will say, oh, my child's bored, therefore let me give them an iPad. That's actually a parental emotion. Your kids actually, they're not going to necessarily understand boredom until a little bit later, maybe around the pre-operational stage, around 2 to 7. And even then, boredom is a very interesting emotion because it could be a lack of curiosity, you know, and you want to kind of engage them to see their environment a little bit differently. So, I mean, I know that with emotional regulation, you want to be mindful of that a little bit. I know mirror neurons is like where you understand the whole, you know, you're seeing your whole face. A lot of eye contact is really important for kids. They're seeing you and talking to you. They're recognizing your tone. So, you know, typically I often try to tell families, if you're going to go out to eat, stare at your kids. You know, it's really important that, like, you know, that you have this relationship with them, very much like the way I'm speaking to you. It's like eye contact, really important for your kids right around from like 0 to 4, to see as much as they can for that, because they start to understand feelings. That's where they understand, oh, dad's a little frustrated with me, or mom's a little embarrassed when I made that scream because she looks like she's kind of a little upset and I don't know what's going on. And oh my gosh, I just annoyed my sister. And I think when I threw something over there, it hit her in the head. And I got, so kids need to see that. They need to, like, see lots of interactions, because if they don't see that, they're going to have a difficult time recognizing, you know, that I may have hurt somebody. So anyway, yeah, I mean, because that's bullying is really important. Bullying is such an interesting concept today, because we have all these, I hope I'm not going all over the place, but I mean, bullying, for example, is, you know, we look at bullying as, we have all these anti-bullying tactics in schools and everything else, but you really can't even understand bullying unless you really understand human emotion, you know? And so anyway, yeah. So, I mean, I
be another podcast, bullying.
Yeah, that is, I know. I think I'm going in a totally different direction, but yeah. So, I mean, I think I love where you're going. Like, I think it's good that we try to get the parents at least to have a superordinate goal, but also just to have some type of understanding about, you know, where their child is at. And then we can maybe talk about a plan on, you know, how to raise that child in a really appropriate way. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
No, I agree. I think it's very multifaceted. And I also think that every child also is unique. So, you know, for example, children who might be on the spectrum or have complex medical needs, I think there are also a lot of layers and nuance to this as well. And that's why I think understanding the development, working with providers in place, just to understand also how your child as an individual processes information, or how those are impacting, you know, in the instance, let's say, of a medical condition that might be impacting developmental milestones. You don't want to have that expectation necessarily at this age. They might be doing this. They may not be at that point, and that's okay. And I think that's the other thing I noticed too with parents. Mm. I don't know. There's a great Bluey episode on this, and it always makes me laugh. But that's beside the point.
No, a little bit. Is it Louis C.K. episode? Is that what you said, Louis?
Bluey.
Oh, Bluey. Oh, okay. Yeah, Bluey. Okay.
That my son's really into right now.
Totally different.
Yeah.
I was thinking Louis C.K. You're thinking of something else. Okay, keep going.
Where it's almost like, you know, if my child isn't hitting developmental milestones by a certain point, oh no, the world's coming to an end. What am I doing wrong? And it's almost like a competition where you're at the playground and you're like, that kid's doing monkey bars. Okay, you know, why don't you get up there and you try the monkey bars next? You know, let's see.
Right.
And there's, I don't want to say competitive, but I think there's a sense of urgency of, am I doing everything to prepare my child for the world? And when you see other kids doing things that are around the same age, you then kind of build this expectation of, oh, my kid should be doing that too. Why aren't they doing that? Oh, that must mean I'm failing at something, or what's wrong? And I think that's where it's important too, where every child is unique and there may be things that your child really excels at. And there might be things that your child needs more time in developing. And so also being patient, tuning into the strengths and yeah, just tuning into the uniqueness that is your
child. Where do you think we get that guilt? Like, because it seems like it's very self-centered in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, I'm just going to be honest with myself, like it's like whenever I have those worries, it's more about me and then the child. I mean, do you think it's that or not to be too? Yeah. I mean, it seems like to be a more comparative mindset, like my child isn't where that child is, but I'm making it more about myself where do you think that comes from? Or is it something different? Everyone's different though. So yeah.
They are. I mean, I also wonder the cultural role in that. I wonder if that's something that happens in other cultures as well, or what that looks like. I feel like it just, at least for me, I see it so much, around here. And I think, again, I think it's the expectation as parents that, you know, yes, we are responsible for this other human being, this life. At the same time, I think, what does that responsibility mean and what does that look like?
Right.
It doesn't mean that there's an expectation for you to be perfect. And I think it's, and I don't know, maybe for other people, they don't have that same instinct where it turns inward. I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question. I kind of went on a little.
No. It's this is drinks and shrink with shrinks. So we're just kind of free for all. We didn't quite.
I wish I could blame it on the hotty toddy, my ramble, but.
I know. Yeah. Did you make one recently?
I should.
I know. Well, yeah, we could talk for hours about like where this a lot of this comes from. I'm always a fan of is speak for yourself. Try not to speak for where they're coming from.
Yeah.
And then it's like, if you're worried, that's one thing, but your worry might not be your child's worry. And also the other thing too, I mean, a lot of the research out there, it's most of the research, and I'm thinking of Steven Pinker's book, The Blank Slate, he offended a lot of parents and he offended a lot of child development psychologist, because basically at the end of the day, he was just kind of like, it's kind of genetics. And as much as you try, they're going to kind of do what they want to do at the end of their lives. And you're going to have to just do the best you can. And you can't really control a lot of stuff. You can control some of it, but most of it, you just can't. And so what you want to work on is really teaching your kids on how to have a proper mindset. You know, it's like, let's look at disabilities, for example. Yeah. I've seen more success with my kid clients when I could help them build a sense of resilience in their disability, rather than having everybody come rescue them from their disability.
Thank
it's you. Like, okay, you know, it's like, you've got ADHD. Great. Well, ADHD for, especially with a lot of boys, it's kind of like, they've learned how to cope. It's almost like they will use it as a distraction so that they don't want to deal with the failure. And so if I can help them deal with failure a little bit better, then maybe they won't be so distracted. You know, it's all these other, so it's kind of like helping your kids have a particular mindset. I found that to be really helpful. So there's a lot of factors here that we're talking about, but one thing I would just say, if you're going through like your kid's not where the milestone, like they're not at a proper milestone, how does your kid deal with that? Like, is your kid okay with that? Because one thing about Eric Erickson that he talks about with all of his different stages, he's got 8 different stages. You could kind of break that down to how people deal with failure. And if you have a really healthy view of failure, you actually thrive when you're going through difficult situations. And so one of the things I often see with parents is they often want to rescue their kids from difficulties or failures, or it's kind of like that. I remember one time I went to a soccer game and I saw this dad literally running with his child on the soccer match. And I'm like, oh my gosh, dude, what are you doing? You know, it's like, please stop. And he looked so bold and so zealous. And you could tell that he felt like he was doing the right thing. And it was just like, buddy, no, you're not. Your kid has to fall, you know, and he wants to be there because he wants to, quote, rescue that kid from falling. And when you rescue kids from falling, those kids are actually a lot more clumsy. And you see them at the park. If you go to the local park, you can see kids that are highly clumsy. It's often the parent that's constantly rescuing. Kid has not learned how to walk properly. And so what you really want to do is you want your kid to fall and hit themselves and even sometimes even be hit by another kid and see how they deal with the conflict before you rescue out. I remember one time with my third child, I would have never done this my first two, but I did it with my third because I started relaxing a little bit. Hannah started having a conflict with another little boy, and the other little boy like hit her on the shoulder. And I immediately wanted to come in and rescue, and I decided to back off and just kind of see what happened. I just wanted to see what happens. And Hannah then got very close to that little boy. She became very assertive with him. And she said, don't hit me. And the boy what kind of backed off. And he said, sorry. And then he gave her a toy. And then Hannah said, thank you. And then she walked away. And it was just like, whoa, that was a really powerful interaction. And if I had actually gotten in there and said, hey, young Moran, what are you doing hitting my daughter? It would have completely ruined that whole interaction between my little girl and that boy. And they would have never actually had that wonderful opportunity to resolve their own conflict. You need to let your kids be able to do that. And so milestones, I do wonder, you know, it's like we're all different when it comes to milestones. I mean, you know, some kids just, they don't talk until much later, but they're realizing it's likely because they're observing a lot more in their environment. You just don't know. And so I guess with all this, just try to, you know, try to separate your own stuff from your kids' stuff. I guess that's one thing. And also let your kids fail. Let your kids make mistakes because that's so essential for them. You know, that it's really productive that they learn how to do that. And I wonder if a lot of parents have this weird fear of failure. You know what I mean? And they're like, oh, my kid could never face failure. I'm like, well, who taught you that? Because failure is wonderful, like when you really think about this. So, you know,
reframe around failure.
Yeah, failure is wonderful. Like when you really like let that sink. Yeah, it's awesome. It's how we grow. It's how we anyway. Yeah. So I'd not want to
here. I'm 100% with you though, because I think in those moments where you fall down, you learn a different way of how to approach it next time. You're learning about what you can do or how to do it differently. And I'm not saying just falling down is the only example, but just that idea of if you don't fall, you can't reassess what to try differently next time. You can't, you don't have that opportunity. There's an opportunity there to learn a different way. And I think also like hearing the story with your daughter, it's that confidence too, in that I do have this ability to do that. And what a gift that is to have that confidence in yourself to say, hey, like to be able to take pride in, hey, I tried it this way and I didn't fall down. I didn't stumble, like the excitement and the joy in that. Because you had the opportunity, but that only happened because you learned from whatever that failure was.
And that's the role of a parent that I think is very influential for the rest of your life, that whether they're 5 or whether they're 50, if they could come to you as a sounding board when they fail or make risks in their lives, and you're there for them to process those risks in a very supportive, but not demanding nor like overly preachy way, like that's so helpful for us as, you know, children and for your kids as well, to like come to you and to say, hey, mom, had this interaction with this kid at school. He was kind of a jerk to me. And then I stood up to him and then he walked away. And guess what? He's nicer to me now. And like, that's just really cool. You don't feel like you have to call the principal. You don't feel like you have to call the teacher. You're like, you know, wow. Okay. Tell me more about that. Like, you can have those conversations for the rest of your lives. Look for those opportunities. Because I think a lot of parents, they feel like they have to just, we get overly worried when we know, it's kind of like Gottman, right? So 70% of the relationships, 70% of the problems that we have in relationships are what? Unsolvable. They're perpetual. I would say the same thing when it comes to parenting. Probably 70% of the stuff that your kids get into at the end of the day, they're just going to be perpetual. So try to build and facilitate a conversation where you go from gridlock, where your kid doesn't feel like they can come to you, to a place of open dialogue, because you're probably going to have to face a lot of this for most of your life. And then try to really focus on solvable stuff, which is only about 29-30%, you know, making sure your kid goes to school, making sure they, you know, brush your teeth, make it like that. You need that stuff. Like, absolutely. But, you know, focus on the right thing and not focus on things that are, you know, that parental guilt though. You're right. It's very invasive. It's all throughout the culture. I mean, I don't know where it comes from. I mean, I have my ideas, but I don't have anything like definite, like this is definitely where it's
right. Doing the research.
Right.
But I'm so curious now. I kind of want to go explore.
I know, maybe next week.
Yeah. Maybe I'll share my findings. And I think to your point too, around, you know, perpetual solvable, but also that idea of try not to fix it. This idea of if along some of the topics we've been talking about today, maybe lead with more curiosity, and allow for your child to make mistakes, ask questions to learn about how they saw it. What did you do when that child said that to you? You know, just asking questions, get curious about it. And I think it helps them also to find their own voice, in the process. But take that pressure off of yourselves to feel like we have to solve it. We have to fix it. We have to do all these things.
Yeah. Right. What have been some of your, I don't know if you wanted to share, how much time do you have? You have just a few minutes?
I have more time.
Yeah. Okay. But anything that I didn't mind sharing with our audience, struggles that we have as parents, and I don't mind sharing my.
I'm open to that too.
Yeah.
I have to think of some. You want to go first, Peter? What are some of the?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I was a huge helicopter parent when my firstborn. My wife would laugh at me, and I was definitely the guy that was like constantly following my little girl around. I have videos of me doing that. And having more kids was essential for me because I realized, oh my gosh, you know, going through it like the third time, I'm like, okay, she's going to be okay. So I struggled with that in the very beginning, I think. And then when Eli was born, a lot less. And then definitely with Hannah, I just like, she's fine, whatever. And it's so funny because my own parents had five children. And I think when my youngest brother was born, it got to the point where, like, you know, he'd be on the roof and my parents were just like, whatever, just if he jumps inside the leaves, I don't care. He won't break his. And if he breaks his leg, just call me. But hey, I'm busy. That was kind of their approach, you know? So, but no, I don't know if I sometimes had parental guilt once in a while. I think all of my kids, they had different milestones. Some of them reached them a whole lot quicker than others. You know, one of them in particular took a while for her to reach those, but now she thrives in all of them. So I would just say to parents, like, it's, you know, and seeing this with my own kids, but also just having clients who are children, I used to see a lot of kids. I don't see them as much as I used to. It's going to be, you know, just wait. It's okay to wait. Like, you don't have to, like, we're not... Kids are not left brain dominant. And what I mean by that, milestones is a very left brain dominant perception of reality, but it's not reality all the time because we have two different brains. We have a left and a right brain. And I'm taking Ian McGilchrist's kind of perspective here, that a right brain perspective is a little bit more nuanced and gray. And your kids are kind of right brain dominant in the very beginning. They're highly curious and they're not... The milestones that we have in place, and I'm talking about the extreme milestones. I'm not talking about general milestones. I'm talking about, okay, your kid has to be reading perfectly by the time they're five. Well, no, you know, just, you know, it's good. Your kid has to be super, super extroverted by the time they're seven. It's like, well, a little bit. You want to make sure that they're reaching some of those. Absolutely. But it's okay to give yourself a little grace and wait and make sure that you're having open-ended discussions with your children. You know, anyway, I don't know if I really shared as much as, pivoted that toward preaching, but you can, which I have a tendency to.
I appreciate those points. I think they're all important. And I only have one right now. And And I think in the beginning, there was a lot of things. I know his speech was a little bit more delayed. And that was, I think, part of the parental guilt I felt early on. And I think in focusing only on this, on his speech, for example, I also lost sight of the things that he was doing. Like, he was such a curious little boy, and he was always just so aware of what was going on around him. And, you know, the fear though of, oh no, he's not talking yet. He didn't say mama or dada. He hasn't done that yet. Oh no, like, crisis, the world's coming to an end. I think it took a lot to step back and say, whoa, hold on, it's okay.
Yeah.
And just to say, it's okay.
Right.
And believe that. And I think too, you know, definitely, I'm not going to lie, totally the hovering helicopter parent. And I think that was driven more by, he also had some accidents when he was younger. And so for me, there was a little bit of a trauma response. I'm not going to lie.
Protect.
But then I also think, you know, I got him involved in some of the things at the local Y, because they had like a gymnastics thing in the morning. And you know, again, me projecting, right? Where seeing him at this point, he was more like crawling, kind of wobbly, learning to walk. And just seeing him fall and not feeling like, because that's what happened. Someone accidentally, he was dropped when he was younger, and he had serious injury. So for me, like, that was the fear. Like, I have to protect. I don't want to.
Yeah. Right. You know, that's hard. Yeah. That's really hard. Yeah.
But seeing him fall and seeing him kind of even giggle to himself and just step back up, it's kind of like, okay, I don't have to. He's okay.
Yeah.
He's not going to break. He's not this fragile thing that has to be bubble wrapped. He's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think I just had to have more and more experiences to build up my own confidence in, okay to step back. It's okay to, he's not hurt. He's okay. And that was my own. And again, I think it was also informed by a little bit more trauma on my side, the work that I had to do, but not projecting that onto him. And I think another hard example too was, he goes to daycare, and this, I think, is another example of resilience, you know, just leaving my child there when he's screaming. They had to peel him off of me. You know, I think I took the day off more for my own self than because I was worried they were to call me, but like, it was hard and it's heart wrenching. But then I would call and they would be like, oh no, he's playing, he's fine.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. So it's just me in tears in the car going through a box of tissues. Okay. But I think that's an example of kids are so resilient. And I think, again, just giving them that space and being kind to themselves in the process.
I love you bring up a really good cycle in the sense of, like, it's not just about the kid. It's actually about you. And like, seeing your kid build resilience is actually just as good for us as parents as it is for them. You know, so it is that recycling. It's like, wow, my kid actually did. I know what you mean. Yeah. I'm right there with you as far as, I remember dropping my little Lizzie off at the nursery and just like, it was bloody murder.
That's
and
horrible.
And I think I went outside and listened to Metallica just so I wouldn't hear the screams. And then I called back and they were like, no, she's fine. She's like totally engaged. And she's like laughing at other people. And that would happen literally every single time. So I got to the point where it's like, okay, there's going to be a scream now. And it's like, whatever, I'm just going to walk out. Because I know they're going to be okay.
It's like, we all as human beings make so much meaning. We're meaning generators. And I think it's through these experiences, we develop different filters for how to make meaning of that cry. Of actually, that cry doesn't mean that something's terribly wrong, but that it's a natural part. It's part of their attachment to us. And it's okay for them to feel that way. And it's not that they're in crisis.
Yeah. So I guess as we close, when parents disagree, how should we, so to sum up
everything. I know,
No, that's okay. Yeah, no. So when parents disagree, one of the things we would say is, number one, read a book on child development. Number two, build an action plan where you both can definitely agree. Number three, try to understand that resilience is really good for your kids and build a theory around that. Because I think a lot of parents don't assume that. I think a lot of parents will immediately, Because you want your, you do want your parenting to be somewhat linked to research in the way that overall this is good for kids, right? So as Gottman therapists would say, like, okay, the, you know, criticism's not good for your marriage. So let's change it with soft startup, you know, in the same way, resilience is really good for kids. So let's try to encourage your all's parenting to build that in some way and to take initiative and, right. and to, you know, have a mindset and to also be compassionate to yourself is what a lot of what you're, what I'm hearing from you. It's because you do want your kids to realize and have the mentality. This is the problem I have with parents who put so much, so many demands on being perfect. You set yourself up for a huge amount of failure if you really want that. Do you really want to be perfect? Right. Like, and I sometimes ask that. I remember one client, I asked, it's like, do you really want to be the perfect mom? And she was like, well, what do you mean? It's like, no, let's sit with that for a second. Like, if you're really the perfect mom, what would happen? And she, I just like, I wanted her to be like, really sit with that. Mm-hmm. And she was like, oh my gosh, that would be awful. And I said, why? And she was like, because my kid would feel so guilty if they ever committed a failure. And I'm like, wow. Yeah. And I wasn't surprising that. That answer really kind of threw me off. I'm like, yeah, that's actually pretty insightful. Do you want your kid to beat the crap out of himself if he makes a mistake? And she was like, no. Well, if you're the perfect mom, you would have to. So, I mean, do you really want to be the perfect parent? Like, you know, is that really what you're setting yourself up to? You know? So it's like, sometimes we just need to ask ourselves that kind of reflective questioning to ourselves. And I often say that it's like, do you really want that for yourself? You know, and I would just kind of say, that's a good start to show some type of compassion to yourself and in a,
to one
in
another.
A, yeah. Yeah. Because also, I mean, I should lean this too. Men and I often see that men and women do, they do parent differently. Try not to rescue your spouse when you feel like they're being too hard. I've seen that a lot. Typically when I got to pick on the ladies here a little bit, sorry, ladies, but they will, I often will see a lot of my moms immediately interject when they feel like the dad's being too harsh. And I often have to say, back off a little bit, just a little bit. I know that he may be seeing like a little too harsh. Number one, you have to kind of, there's probably a lot of compensation going on. And I'm not talking about abuse. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about raising voice. Men just kind of typically, they tend to be a little bit more firm at times. You know, it just like, it's really good that the two of them learn how to have a relationship. And if you come in there and like interject, you really prevent that relationship from occurring. And it's really vital that you do that. And I know it's not just, I mean, men can do it just as, they're just as guilty, but I see that more maybe with, some of my clients and just trying to help her maybe not interject when she feels like he's being too firm. Mm-hmm. If he's being too firm, okay, well, give your kids the resources and the tendencies to say to their dad, hey dad, I feel like you're being too firm.
Right.
And don't immediately assume that your child can't do that. So tell you a little bit about my own. My oldest daughter, she's 10. She will actually come up to me and say, daddy, you're too firm with me. And I'm like, you know what? I kind of was. I'm sorry, Lizzie. What I really meant was this. And I'll sit with her and I'll be like, this is what I meant. And we have this really nice little relationship, right? And it's helped me as a father to explain things in a little softer startup. It's made me a better dad. It's helped our relationship and it's given her the assertiveness to come to her daddy and say, hey, you're too firm. You actually want that, and vice versa. If, you know, dads don't interject, if mom is like really kind of like laying into the kids and you feel, don't rescue, just take a step back and see what happens. Because it could be that she's really trying to get to the bottom of some things. And maybe you feel like she's like being too hard with her, you know, with her little girl, but see what happens. Just back off a little bit. That's the other thing too. When parents disagree, don't try to rescue unless it's like absolutely like you're, maybe if you're, it's one thing if like one spouse is super flooded. And in those situations, sometimes I'll just say, hey, babe, why don't I take over? Or she'll come up to me. Why don't I take over? And that's the sense like, it's really great to accept influence. But I will just say to parents, just kind of lay low for a little bit, like see how that dynamic plays itself out. Because 99% of the time, it's going to be okay. It's going to really improve that relationship. I don't know if you see that sometimes with your clients, but that's something
I do. Yeah. And I think there's a lot to what you're saying around to sit in whatever the discomfort is that you're feeling as a partner, as a parent, and to not necessarily project that onto the interaction itself and to just observe, to get curious, to witness. And like you're saying, and offers there to be a natural consequence, or for there to be in that individual, you both are going to have individual relationships with your kid, and then also a collective one. And I think in that individual relationship, getting curious about it, just because it's different than maybe my relationship, doesn't mean it's wrong. So not falling into that dichotomy of right versus wrong, but to appreciate its difference. And also, like you were saying, it allows for a child to be able to say or voice, you know, what they need, or and for there to be that organic shift in the relationship, right. Just naturally. Mm-hmm. But if we're too quick to jump in, it also could be something, one, where we're acting in a situation where we don't fully understand the dynamic that's playing out, because we're kind of projecting our own way onto that. Yeah. And that's robbing that unique connection there. But also, we're creating urgency in something that maybe not be so urgent. It doesn't require intervention. And it creates tension, because I imagine for that other parent, if I were to go in a situation like that with my husband, I imagine he might feel like I'm undermining him a little bit. Like I'm taking away his position as a father. So I think also sometimes in observing and being curious, I'm conveying also my respect for your role. And I'm understanding how you go about your role might be a little bit different than how I go about it. But it's not wrong. It's just a different way.
And I think men need to also accept the influence of their wives to bring in that kind of emotional intelligence. I mean, because of the amount of, you know, y'all carried this baby for 9 months. So women do have, just through estrogen and everything else, there's this huge amount of emotional intelligence that they give the kids that I think men can immediately assume, oh, she's coddling her or him. And I want my boy to be tough or whatever. And that's, yeah, you do want your boy to have resilience. When a resilience is not the same though as, you know, denying the emotions. But I think, yeah, whenever I have like, whenever two parents are not on the same page, they'll tend to over dominate on their quote role. But when they're on the same page and there's a beautiful dance, there's something about fathers wrestling with their kids and poking at them and making and bringing this kind of levity. Let's not take everything so seriously. Come on, dude, let's go. That's so good. At the same time, it's also this beautiful thing in interaction that doesn't always work when he really needs to kind of talk through some stuff, you know, and just kind of slow down. And my wife does such a beautiful job talking to my all three of my children, and she spends so much time with them at bedtime. And just like it brings all of it together. And I really think she just brings such a beautiful amount of emotional intelligence to our kids in that way. My approach to bedtime is like, go to bed. All right. Good night. Okay. Yes. All right. Say a prayer. Okay. Good night. Okay. Which is, you need both, you know, I mean, I think you need both, and just try to go with that dance. Now that's typical. I'm being kind of stereotypical, I guess, a little bit, you know, but, yeah.
But I appreciate what you're saying, because I think valuing, again, how each of you might have a different approach, it balances each other. They're, you know, children get so many more needs met because you both are attending to different needs, and they're, so I guess it's like, again, when we're not trying to jump in and have it just be one way, but when we allow each of us to build that unique relationship with our kids, that again, it creates this overall balance in the picture. And I think it's appreciating each of your contributions in that way, that you both are bringing value, that you both are bringing something really special.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we probably have to end, but we've almost went to an hour. We are. We keep going.
Happy today.
I know. Oh, well, great. Yeah. Right. Well, Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. We would like to try to make it somewhat short, but hey, we could keep going. But if anybody has any questions, please send us an email, AndersonFamTherapy@gmail.com, or comment on our TikTok or YouTube channels, anything, anywhere else. Any closing thoughts?
I really love this topic today.
Yeah, nice. I do. I know the more we're getting into it, I could probably go for another hour. And same. Maybe that's when you could go fix your hot toddy. So go fix a hot toddy. I'll send you the recipe.
Yes, please. I don't know if you have. I'm doing that next.
It really will. It'll knock that cold out right away.
I'm excited.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. And feel free to,
send us your next
week. Yeah. All right. We'll hope to hear from you soon. Thanks for listening. All right. Thanks, y'all. Bye.